What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Damian Lewis, author of the book Churchill's Hellraisers, The Secret Mission to Storm a Forbidden Nazi Fortress. Damian, welcome to the New Books Network.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Yeah, sure. So obviously I'm a Brit, and I spent pretty much two decades as a war and conflict reporter. So basically filing stories from those parts of the world where most people don't like to go because they are consumed by war and conflict. And I was doing that mostly for television news channels. And on one of those assignments, I came across a story which a publisher asked me if I'd be willing to write the story as a book, and I agreed. And that was about 17 years ago, I guess. And that was an international bestseller. And so I've spent the next 17 years largely writing books, and a lot of them have tended to end up being about World War II, which has always been a big interest of mine, and which I feel is an iconic conflict, to the appeal of which and the unique presence of which is really never going to go away.
What was it that led you to write a book about this raid in particular? What was it that drew you to it? And what was it you feel that you could add to that our understanding of it?
So Churchill's Hellraisers concerns a raid undertaken by the Special Air Service, British Special Forces, in World War II in 1945. And what makes it stand out is that it was an operation the likes of which had never been tried before by any special forces anywhere in the world. It was an attack on the 14th Army headquarters in Italy. So a massive two huge fortified villas in northern Italy, defended by around about 1,000 troops and with everything up to heavy armor. And that's not the kind of target that special forces operations ever normally go for. Generally speaking, especially in World War II, these were hit-and-run operators who would attack a train or a road convoy or a lightly guarded target which they could strike at, often targeting senior enemy officers, and then melt away again very quickly to run away and live to fight another day, as they described it. So this was something completely different, and you know, it piqued my interest because it stood out as being so unique, and it had that kind of where eagles dare feel about it, which made me want to investigate further.
Before we get into the operation itself, I was wondering if you could set for us the context. Like, what was going on in northern Italy where the 14th Army was located? What was happening at that point in the war? And how were the Allies and the Germans approaching the situation at that time?
Yeah, fascinating question. So, of course, the thrust through southern Italy, so obviously, you know, the D-Day landings were coming. when the landings in southern Italy were launched. And it, you know, Churchill and Roosevelt had been told that Italy was going to be the soft underbelly of Europe. Well, it turned out to be anything but. In fact, of course, those American and British and Australian and New Zealand and Commonwealth troops who fought their way up through Italy became known as the D-Day Dodgers because they didn't partake in D-Day. It's completely unjustified because the fighting in Italy was absolutely extremely bloody and hard fought. When Hitler realized what the Allies were planning, he vowed that Italy would not fall. And even when the Italians surrendered and joined forces with the Allies, Hitler redoubled his efforts to hold Italy. And he sent Field Marshal Kesselring, who was one of his top commanders, very highly respected by Allied commanders, I have to say. So he sent Kesselring to Italy, and he tasked Kesselring not to let Italy fall no matter what. And he also sent some of his really best panzer divisions and Alpine troops to Italy to make sure it would not fall. And so all the way through late 43 and 44, Allied forces had been grinding their way up the Italian the mainland. There had been series of amphibious landings, but it had been extremely hard fought and bloody the whole way. You know, huge numbers of Allied troops expended in that struggle. And come the autumn of 44, and the coming winter of 44, which turned out to be one of the harshest winters in living memory in Italy, Allied forces were bogged down on something they called the Gothic Line. And the Gothic Line was a string of supposedly impregnable defences, massively reinforced by the Germans, running through the Apennine Mountains in northern Italy, which consisted of gun emplacements, bunkers, trenches, barbed wire, machine gun posts, a really fearsome set of defences. And add to that the fact the forces were bogged down in the winter snows. Allied commanders feared that no breakthrough was coming. And so it was decided that behind the lines missions would have to be launched by Allied special forces, dropping in behind the Gothic Line to link up with Italian partisans and the Special Operations Executive, an OSS American equivalent, agents already embedded with them, to try to foment chaos and havoc in the enemy's rear in an effort to try to break the Gothic Line. And the story told in Churchill's Hellraisers is one of those missions.
You've mentioned the partisans, and as you make it clear in your book, they're a very important part of the story. This is not just an SOE operation or an SAS operation. It's one that is done in conjunction with these partisan groups. And as you explain, make it very clear in the book, it's a very chaotic environment in 1945. So much of what people like Lees and Farrar were doing was as much diplomacy and personnel management in order to make this happen as it was necessarily military strategy or tactics or operations.
Yeah, it's what the SAS, they coined the phrase hearts and minds. These were hearts and minds operations as much as they were offensive operations. So, you know, when the 14th Army headquarters was identified as a key target, with the potential possibly to kill or capture Kesselring himself and his other top generals who were based there, when it was identified as a target, you know, Allied commanders could spare 40 SAS soldiers to parachute behind the lines. And obviously 40 SAS soldiers, no matter how good they are never going to take on and defeat a 1,000 strong defending force. So they needed a force multiplier. They needed, obviously, to up their numbers. And the only way to do that was to work with and recruit the Italian partisans. So these were freedom fighters who had gathered in the Italian mountains to fight the Nazis and drive them out of Italy. And a hodgepodge band of other combatants who could be recruited to the cause. So this included 100 at least Russians who had been captured on the Eastern Front, had been brought to Italy basically as slave labour to work on the defences, stiffening the defences of the Gothic lines under German captivity, and had escaped, got into the mountains and gathered under their leader, a former Russian army captain, and had become freedom fighters themselves. And there was added to that some French Foreign Legionnaires some veterans of the Spanish Civil War, a Dutch army sergeant who somehow had found his way from Holland all the way to the Italian mountains to fight, and even a handful of German deserters. These were individuals who had really decided that, you know, the Nazi cause was lost, and indeed that much of what Nazi Germany's forces were up to in Italy was unconscionable by this time, and that they'd changed sides. And just to give you an indication of what was happening and why German soldiers found the actions of their own troops unconscionable and unsupportable, because the operations of the Italian partisans had been so effective, a Kesselring estimated 20,000 German troops by now had been killed or injured by partisan operations. Hitler had ordered that for every German death, there would be 10 Italians killed. And that was 10 Italians, regardless of who they were. So what would happen is there would be an Italian partisan raid. Germans would be killed. And the SS, Gestapo and troops would go into the nearest village, round everybody up and massacre the whole village. And so there were countless villages across Italy where hundreds of men, women and children were killed, including the village priest, including the babies. And this had obviously turned the stomachs of some of those German soldiers who'd come over to the Allied side. So that was the amorphous polyglot band that somehow SAS Major Roy Farron and SOE Captain Lees had to try to meld into a united fighting force to take on this, what is basically a real-life Mission Impossible. And something that's really fascinating, I find, if you think about it, if you were one of the SAS men serving in British uniform, if you were captured, you stood a reasonable chance of being treated as a prisoner of war. So being held in captivity, held in a prisoner of war camp, and repatriated at war's end. If you were an Italian partisan captured by the enemy, dressed in your hodgepodge of uniform and civilian clothes, not only would you be tortured and executed, but very likely all your family and all your village would suffer the same fate. So the stakes involved to convince the Italian partisans to join forces with these few dozen SAS and attack the 14th Army headquarters were enormous. And the fact Farron and Lees and the other commanders managed to win the hearts and minds of the locals and convince them they could do this is one of the real gems of the story.
And to make it even more complicated, when you talk about partisan, you're not talking about necessarily a group that all had the same views and the same goals. You're talking about an incredibly diverse group that consists of people, the Green Flames, the conservatives. You're talking about the communists. And these are people that, you know, are not necessarily ones who work well together. So partisan is a very generic term that simplifies the task that was really before them and simply bringing in that group to participate.
Absolutely, yeah. No, couldn't be truer. And the point about it is that because the majority were communists by name, the Allies, the British in particular, had by this time, so we're talking late autumn, winter 44, started to question the policy of dropping in arms and supplies and weaponry and funds to the partisans, because they were looking forward to the Cold War and thinking, you know, Russia's going to be the new enemy, and these Italian partisans, a lot of them are nominally communist, are they going to make common cause with Russia? Are we therefore arming and empowering our future enemies? And it's a real sting in the tail of the book that the effort to attack this 14th Army headquarters and bring about an end to the war in Italy and save thousands and thousands of Allied and Italian lives was hampered to a very great extent by the secret blocking of support from very high echelons of British and American high command, but mainly British, because of that fear. A fear which, incidentally, come war's end, proved utterly unfounded.
So we've talked a lot about the complicated factors involved in the operation. Well, let's talk a bit about the people we've already referred to, Mike Lees and Roy Farron. I was wondering if you could describe a bit about them, because they really come across as these rather remarkable personalities and very distinctive individuals.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Mike Lees, a real boy's own hero, born to a Catholic family in England, went to top public schools in the UK. That's privately funded schools. Age 18, joined the Territorial Army, and very shortly thereafter signed up to fight in the war, and didn't really get a great deal of action, although he was in an airborne unit, was very frustrated, and he heard about a secretive body of warrior agents, which were known colloquially as the Tweed Cap Boys, referring to the cloth flat caps that some of them wore. And he realized and he heard that they were actually fighting deep behind the lines in enemy-occupied Europe, and he decided that's what he wanted to do. The problem was you could only join this was the Special Operations Executive, Churchill's Ministry for Ungentlemanly Warfare, as it became known, the ministry he set up to wage war, no holds barred, against, breaking all the rules, assassinations, covert operations, raising guerrilla armies, doing everything and anything, because Churchill believed, and rightly believed in my opinion, that World War II was a total war, and only by fighting it, no hold barred, would we defeat the Nazi enemy. So Lees heard about this organization and realized that the trouble was the only way he could get in was by invitation, and you only got an invitation to join if you were one of those known to somebody in there already. And so with a remarkable feat of bluff and chutzpah, Lees blagged his way into the SOE by pretending to be the schoolboy chum, the schoolboy pal of one of the SOE agents. And by the time he was in, they realized they had a remarkable recruit on our hands. And very quickly, they deployed him to behind-the-lines operations in Yugoslavia, the then Yugoslavia, which, of course, was the supply line for the Germans to get their war material and their soldiers to Greece, which was then the front line. And Lees launched a string of sabotage operations against those railway operations, working closely with the Yugoslav Chetniks, their guerrilla forces. And then, out of the blue, he was ordered by SOE headquarters to cease offensive operations with the Chetniks. And so, being the kind of individual he was, which is very, very strong-willed and single-minded, and absolutely determined to keep fighting the enemy no matter what, because he'd been ordered to stop operations with the Chetniks, he decided to go off and launch a string of solo sabotage operations on his own. So single-handedly, he went and blew up a load of German trains, and then he was extracted from Yugoslavia and retasked and sent to Italy, by which time he'd earned the nickname Mike Wildman Lees because of his operations in Yugoslavia. He was seen as a rising star within the SOE. He was sought by the British Secret Intelligence Service to be recruited there. And SOE said, well, you can have him, but only after the war's fought, because we need him to help win the war. And shortly after arriving in Italy, he was parachuted behind the Gothic line. And once he was on the ground there, linked up with the partisans and sent out reconnaissance forces, and realized that the 14th Army, which was a base, as I say, for the top German generals, offered this incredible target, which might turn the tide of the war in Italy. And having carried out reconnaissance in person, disguised as an Italian native of the headquarters and returning unharmed, he realized that with his partisans and his Russian fighters and his French Foreign Legionnaires, he didn't have the tip of the spear, the professional fighting forces he needed to take it on. And so he radioed headquarters and said, could you send me some commandos or equivalent, because I need that force to take on this target. And it just so happened that there was an SAS major in Italy at the time, just arrived there, called Major Roy Farron, who had already won the Military Cross, so a high valor decoration, twice in the war, which in itself was an incredible achievement. A legendary SAS commander by now, at one stage so badly injured that he was told he could no longer take part in frontline operations, his response to which was to volunteer for the SAS. Another time, held captive by the enemy, escaped and executed such an incredible, epic escape across the Mediterranean that he was awarded the Military Cross. Farron happened to be in Italy at the time, just arrived there, actually under the command of the Americans. And he heard about Mike Lees's request for a force of commandos or SAS to help spearhead the attack on the 14th Army headquarters. And he sensed the mission of a lifetime, one that might change the course of the war in Italy. And he went to his American commander and said, sir, you know, will you green light this operation? And he got the green light. And then he said, but the American commander said, there's one condition. I can't let you go and lead this operation in person because I need you here. You're too experienced, and I need experienced commanders because we've lost so many special forces commanders during the war to fatalities. And so Farron said, well, sir, would you just let me ride in the aircraft with my men to see them off? And his American commander said, yeah, of course you can. And so Farron mounted up the C-47 American aircraft and air crew and flew in with his men, 40 of them, 40 raiders. And actually, he was the first man to parachute out the door. And he said to the American air crew before jumping, you will go back to headquarters and you will tell them I was helping dispatch my men and I fell from the aircraft accidentally. And that was my fate. And so he was reported killed in action. And he remained officially killed in action for several days until he came up on the radio from the field where he'd linked up with Michael Leese, requesting further arms and ammunition and equipment to carry out the raid on the 14th Army headquarters, at which stage, of course, headquarters were somewhat annoyed with him, although they couldn't get him back again now. It was impossible to get him back across the Gothic line. And so he said, look, now I'm here, let me command the operation. And he was given the green light, although at the same time he knew he was going to face a court-martial upon his return. That's if they survived.
You've already talked about the reluctance that the with which the Allied command approached the idea of arming the partisans and supporting them as the war was coming to an end. But as you explain in the book, it's not the only reluctance that the high command has about this operation. What were some of the other qualms they had about it, and how they feel about conducting this operation against the headquarters in the context of their overall effort to break through the Gothic line and roll back the Germans?
So special forces, Allied special forces, the SAS, the Special Boat Service, the Seaborne equivalent, the Commandos, and I would imagine US Rangers and equivalent units as well, had not always earned the admiration and friendly relations with high command. Why was that? Because they tended to be mavericks and free thinkers who pretty much operated as they saw fit on the ground. I mean, that really is one of the definitions of special forces operations. They didn't always respect blindly rank and hierarchy. They believed in merit above rank. And they didn't always dress very smartly or particularly adhere to the niceties of uniform. They were, freewheeling, very effective, but not traditional military outfits. And it hadn't always earned them approval from the higher echelons. And so when it became known that Leese and Farron were planning the assault on the 14th Army headquarters, reactions were mixed. Of course, the senior military commanders in Italy knew they needed something to break the impasse, the blockage at the Gothic line. But those in higher command in London and elsewhere never really warmed to these special forces raiders, and they were already pursuing different kind of agendas in Italy, which meant that when push came to shove, were they really going to support such a groundbreaking and ambitious and potentially, impossible undertaking?
Nonetheless, Leese and Farron are there. You have an SAS contingent in place, and they are preparing the operation. I was wondering if you could take us into how they planned it, how they staged it, and how it came off.
Yes, yeah, so one of the key factors, and it's an ingenious and fabulous development, is that Leese realized that amongst the Italian partisans there were these young and very attractive Italian women who were, who were as much fighters as anyone else. But he decided to form them, some of them, into a bespoke outfit, which he named the Staffettas, which is messengers in Italian. And they were tasked to be his intelligence gathering outfit. And what they would do is they would cycle through German checkpoints and German positions. These very pretty Italian women being very friendly, ostensibly. They'd stop and chat, ask for cigarettes, flirt with the German soldiers, and they would find out and gather as much intelligence as they could. And it was via the staffettas that they achieved the key intelligence that they needed to plan the assault on the 14th Army headquarters. Once they had that intelligence, it became a process of arming and equipping the partisans and the Russians in particular to give them the esprit de corps, the sense that they really could pull this operation off. So they got uniforms flown in, they got everything up to howitzers flown in, heavy weaponry, mortars, machine guns, and dropped by parachute into the mountains. And they got hackles and berets from a unit of British soldiers, which happened to be the hackles, which is a feather you wear in your beret, the same colours as the Italian flag, so that the Italian partisans could wear those and feel they were part of this bespoke elite unit that was being put together. And they had badges embroidered with Chi Ostere Vincere. I can't pronounce the Italian perfectly, but it means who dares wins, which of course is the motto of the SAS. And so as far as they could, they made the Italian partisans, the Russians, the French Foreign Legionnaires, the Spanish Civil War veterans all feel they were part of this elite forces outfit to give them the self-belief to enable the attack to go ahead. And when it did, they set off with around about 100 men, 100 raiders, this mixed unit of SAS and the other entities, and all believed that they were going to pull it off. The fly in the ointment, as it were, just as they were setting off, a young boy comes running up to Farron's position, and he thrusts a message into his hand, and it's a radio report from headquarters. And Farron opens it and reads it, and it basically demands him to stand his force down and cancel the operation. There's no reason given. And he looks at his assembled men who've been whipped up into this fever pitch of self-belief. And he thinks to himself, if we don't go ahead and do this now, we never will. I will never get these fighters into this same state of mind again. And in any case, if we cancel it, they will stop believing in us. And he looks at the message and he looks at Captain Lees, who obviously he outranks Lees, so he's in command. And Lees by this stage is very ill with malaria, which he first caught in Yugoslavia. So he's not really of a state of mind to make the decision anyway. And Farron unilaterally decides that he will discard the order, pretend he never received it, and go ahead with the attack anyway. He knows he's risking a court-martial for jumping out of the aeroplane against orders. Can they really court-martial him twice? He doesn't think so. And so they set off through the mountains, out of Italian partisan territory, into German-occupied territory, and 24 hours later, they're in a farmhouse, the Casa del Lupo, the House of the Wolf, overlooking the plains and the last place of hiding before the assault itself.
Now, we tend to have a lot of visions, I think, from movies and as you mentioned, boys' own stories and so forth, of how these things are conducted. And as you explained, it's hardly as though they just simply barged in, guns a-blazing. They were very much aware that even if they succeeded in killing off the 14th Army High Command, that they had to escape, and that was an integral part of the plan as well. What you outlined is a very, carefully thought out way of doing this, how to infiltrate, how to attack, and then how to escape, and how many of the men and women involved in the operation were not actually going to be at the fortress itself, but were going to be protecting the withdrawal and attacking the Germans at that point.
Yeah, so Farron left 20 of his SAS and scores of partisans in the valley from which they at which they had their stronghold, because he knew the Germans would come after them to hunt them down, and unless they had a place of refuge, all was lost. So he left that force there charged with defending the valley at all costs. That was where they were going to retreat to. And then they actually infiltrated the headquarters at midnight on foot, so under cover of darkness, and moving by a technique known as pacing and bearing. Pacing and bearing is a very simple but very difficult to master means of navigating at night, showing no lights and making no noise. And what you basically do is you take a compass bearing on a visible point. Let's say it's a tree. You know it's north. You know the average length of one of your paces. You walk 100 paces. You then know you've walked 100 meters north. You make a mental note of where you are in the map in your head. You then take another bearing. Let's say it's southwest. You then walk another 100 paces on a visible landmark. When you've done those 100 paces, you know you've walked 100 meters southeast. And via that process, Farron, who's at the head of his men, 100 men, snaking through the darkness, manages to navigate their way without being detected all the way through the German defences to what they'd nicknamed the Half Moon Wood, this crescent-shaped patch of woodland just adjacent to the two fortress-like villas where the 14th Army had their communications headquarters and their accommodation building. And at that stage, splits the 100 men into three units. The Russians are sent slightly south to act as a blocking group to stop the German reinforcements getting to the villas when the attack goes noisy. One unit is sent to the Villa Rossi, the Red Villa, where all the generals and high commanders would be sleeping. The other unit is sent to the Villa Calvi, the White Villa, where the communications and command headquarters was. And the idea was that Farron, fearing the level of German reprisals against Italian civilians, against the villages nearby, should they succeed, realized that hundreds and hundreds of Italian villagers would die unless they could stamp an indelible Allied and British signature on the operation. And so, amazingly, the last man he had had parachuted in to join the raiders was a bagpiper, a man who played the bagpipe and had already distinguished himself in several special forces, elite forces operations, bagpiping the raiders ashore from various landing craft. And that man, David the Mad Piper Kirkpatrick, they nicknamed him, was parachuted in to join the operation. And the plan was that on the first sound of his bagpipe, so this eerie, evocative, stirring noise that would ring out across the landscapes, both parties would attack the villas simultaneously. As it happened, the force that went in to attack the White Villa were compromised in that the Germans must have heard something and sent a patrol in on foot to investigate. And so the commander, Lieutenant Harvey, of that force had to attack and kill off that German patrol with a Bren gun. And so the whole operation went noisy, went kinetic, slightly before the piper was scheduled to start his piping. He then started to play as soon as he heard the gunshots ring out. And he and Roy Farron were at a command center where all the men were going to retreat to once the attack was successful and then retreat through enemy terrain back to their stronghold valley from there. And Farron had been very clear. He'd said, look, if you can't manage to seize the upper stories of these two headquarters, you are to set fire to the ground floors and you're to burn the enemy alive. This was brutal, red in tooth and claw, war at its fiercest and most bloody and deadly. And those men being sent in, bear in mind that, you know, Lieutenant Harvey, the commander of the assault party attacking the Villa Calvi, he was 19 years old. This was one hell of a thing to ask of these very young men to undertake. And they went ahead. They seized the both headquarters in bloody fighting, many injured. Lys himself gunned down on the staircase, trying to take the second story of the Villa Rossi, shot five times and left for dead. But they managed to seize the ground floors and set both villas ablaze, causing many casualties before they began this helter-skelter, epic retreat across the plain, back into the mountains. They knew they would be hunted all the way to attempt to get back to their mountain stronghold before being captured by the enemy.
You make it clear that Lys in particular suffered enormously from his injury. And as you explain, he's shot. He can't figure out what has happened to him at that time. But he is, you know, perhaps it's a bit of an exaggeration to say he's semi-invalid, or perhaps it's not. But he has to then be escorted through, and they're having to do this without rest, while, as you know, detail, they're being pursued by some pretty committed Germans.
Yeah, you had a very, very angry defense force, hundreds and hundreds of German troops tasked to hunt down the raiders, because the two villas are ablaze. There's lots of casualties. Ambulances are zooming back and forth up the roads. There are already, bodies been taken to the cemetery, the local cemetery. German commanders are apoplectic with rage. Lys is carried for several hours through the Italian countryside at night on a strapped to a ladder they found in the orchard adjacent to one of the villas. And he's hidden in a barn, which is owned by an old lady who they know is friendly to the resistance. And they leave him there and they say, look, we'll send someone for you. We're going to get you out of here alive. And then the SAS and the other, the partisans and the other raiders, they fuel their escape. It's helter-skelter, non-stop march through the Italian mountains, but using benzodrine, which is basically speed. It's an amphetamine. And by popping those pills, they manage to keep going and stay one step ahead of the enemy. And finally, those who escape make it back to their defensive positions in the mountains without anyone being captured by the enemy. It's an incredible undertaking. But then, of course, the next stage of the operation is to defend that stronghold, their headquarters, as the Germans send in hundreds of troops to try and take that headquarters and hunt them down. So there's another major battle, and it's touch and go as to whether they will succeed before they manage to drive the enemy out, and the battle for that moment is finally over. And Lys, meanwhile, is left in the barn where he was hidden, and it's with the help of the Italian partisans that he manages to execute what has to be one of the most amazing stories of escape of the entire war.
So how successful would you judge the raid? Did they succeed in taking out the entire German high command? Were there some successes? And how, in the end, was the operation received by the high command?
So the mission was so successful because the Germans were in such a state of shock that the Allies could strike at the 14th Army headquarters so far behind their line, so far behind the Gothic line, that they decided the 14th Army headquarters had to be moved, what remained of it. And so it went off air. There were no signals sent or received by the 14th Army headquarters for 15 days, for over 2 weeks, whilst they tried to move it to another safer location. And during that time, the American, British and Allied forces managed to launch their assault on the Gothic line, break through the defences. And meanwhile, Farron and his SAS and the partisans are also operating behind the lines, convincing the Germans that the Allies have broken through when they haven't. And the whole defence of the Gothic line crumbles. So how was the raid received in Allied headquarters? Well, it's a tale of two very different reactions. When the American commander comes through the Gothic line with his armor and his troops, and he meets Farron, who's by then celebrating victory in the field, he decorates him with an American High Valor Medal there and then in the field in recognition of the incredible work he has done in taking out the 14th Army headquarters and enabling the breakthrough. It is only because of that that the British High Command doesn't court-martial him. You know, it's anathema that the British would court-martial someone who's won a High Valor Medal from our closest allies, the Americans, for such an extraordinary operation. So it's the American commander, the American general, who saves Roy Farron from court-martial or worse.
Yet, at the same time, there is this, shall we say, maybe retribution is the right word for it, or definitely resentment. And of course, who becomes the target for that, but if not Farron, but Lys?
Absolutely. So Farron, you know, fortuitously is saved by that, but by the actions of that American commander, rightfully so. Lys, unfortunately, of course, he's executing this epic escape. hijacking an ambulance, dressing in German uniforms, getting plucked out of the Italian mountains by a former Italian Air Force ace flying in a little light German aircraft called a Fiesler Stork to pluck him out of the mountains to safety, saving his life. Not saving him from serious injury. He will carry the injuries for the rest of his life, but at least saving Mike Leese's life. But thereafter, he languishes in hospital, very, very ill for several months. And because of that, because he has no one to champion him, as Roy Farron did, his senior commanders, high command, basically condemn Leese. They accuse him of some of the most egregious crimes you could imagine, disobeying orders, being insulting to his senior commanders, lying about the achievements of his operations. You read the documents, as I have done, which are filed in the British archives. The way he was treated was utterly shocking. And bear in mind, it's doubly shocking because it wasn't Leese who disobeyed the order to attack. That was Roy Farron's doing. And in this incredibly revealing letter that Roy Farron wrote to Christine Bueno, who is Mike Leese's daughter, who's been extremely helpful in helping me write the book. In this incredibly revealing letter that Roy Farron wrote to Christine Bueno on her father's death, he makes it absolutely crystal clear. I commanded the force and I disobeyed the order to stand down the attack. Your father was neither capable medically, physically at the time, or in command to make that decision. And in that letter, he praises Leese in words which are, I've rarely read a senior SS commander praise another warrior in such a way. He calls him this incredible Viking warrior whose men would have followed him to the end of the earth. And the fact that Leese was treated so badly at the end of the war, it is unconscionable, and it's a very sad thing indeed. But in conversations with Christine Bueno, she's made it very clear that Mike Leese was proud, immensely proud of what they had achieved. And he was a big enough individual and with a strong enough spirit to not hold that against those who had so treated him. He was aware of the greater aims that were at stake in that operation, which was the defeat of Nazi Germany and the role that they had played in taking out the 14th Army headquarters.
And to make it clear, Farron didn't wait until Leese's death to honor his what he did in the operation. He was pushing back against the effort to discredit or to demean Leese at the end of the war. And yet, as you explain, that effort ultimately proved unsuccessful, and all those opportunities for Leese that you described at the beginning of the book were not there.
Sorry, I just missed that because the connection dropped out for a second. Yeah. Could you repeat it?
Sorry, I'm going to have to flag this for editing. So I'll pick up, restate the question. And just to make it clear, Farron doesn't wait until Leese's death to champion his cause. You describe how immediately after the war, he is pushing back against the effort to discredit Leese. He's championing Leese's cause. But as you describe, ultimately that proves futile. And all those opportunities that were open to Leese that you described at the war about joining MI6, that all of that evaporates because of the attacks he undergoes because of the operation.
Absolutely, yeah. So Roy Farron, very, 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 a very spirited and right-thinking man, recommends Michael Leese for a military cross after the war's over, and writes up his citation, which praises him for his role in the 14th Army Headquarters assault and for his bravery and courage in leading the assault on the staircase, and for the tenacity with which he dealt with his injuries. That military cross citation, that recommendation, is denied. And Leese is so pilloried in all the correspondence concerning the military cross citation and events thereafter that his potential to be employed by the British, recruited by the British Secret Intelligence Service or indeed by the military, is killed in the process. But as I say, you know, Lys was a big man with a big indomitable spirit, and he went on to forge a career in private business and industry, and he put all that behind him. And I'm glad to say that it didn't rankle with him or make him bitter at all for the rest of his life. He was plagued by his injuries. He was in pain for the rest of his life, but he knew they had done the right thing, and he didn't do it for praise or for decorations. He did it to defeat the Nazis and to help win the war.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yes. So I've just finished writing and I'm just submitting and editing a new book about an SAS operation, which was sent into France just in the aftermath of D-Day to stop Hitler from rushing his panzer divisions, his armor, to the D-Day beaches and driving the Allied landings back into the sea. And so these patrols were dropped far behind the lines to blow up trains and road convoys loaded with armor and to stop that from happening. Incredibly brave and spirited operations. And one of the patrols, which the book follows, they're betrayed and captured, and they are subjected to horrendous torture, and then Hitler orders them executed. And two of the men escape and manage to ensure that at the end of the war, those SS and Gestapo who were basically responsible for the firing squad and carried out the executions are hunted down and brought to trial in 1947. So it's an extraordinary story, and one that I'm really, really proud to have been able to bring to publication.
Well, I look forward to reading that book when it comes out, and I hope that we can perhaps have you back on another podcast to describe it.
Looking forward to it. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us, Damien. I hope you have a wonderful day.
And you. Thank you very much, Mark.